Noi dice il posto
the Torah would state Osama Odam Yaakov, a person should not stand by idly when the welfare of his neighbor is at stake. And the Mepharshim points out that this language of the Chumash is one which is unique, and the Torah, when looking to ensure the welfare of one's neighbor, specifically says in the passive, don't stand by idle. Don't be a passive individual. And the Torah is alluding to the fact that many times when we're able to prevent, help the cause of our fellow, the first thing which we need to overcome is a passive attitude. And specifically in the most important issue which we're going to be dealing with this evening, the Mishnah of Jeffrey Abo states, Ezu Chacham, who is one who is wise, that's the person who is Roa Es Hanolad, who can see that which has yet to come to fruition. And for our purposes this evening, we can certainly say, Roa Es Hanolad, one who can see that which is to be born in the future, that person truly understands what wisdom is about, and they're able to help out their, not only their neighbor, but to help out their progeny as well. That is our discussion this evening. And it's on that note that we have our distinguished honor to have with us two world-class lecturers, Talmidei Chachamim, to share with us their insights this evening. We have with us Rabbi Moshe Tendler and Rabbi Kenneth Brander, both of whom are Rosh Yeshiva, and Yeshiva's Rabbi Yitzhak Al-Khanan, Rabbi Brander leading the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University, and Moshe Rabbi Tendler, one of the highest acclaimed medical authorities in the interface of halakha that we have in our day and age. And there's one person in particular who has helped arrange this event, Rabbi Michael Feldstein. And it's our honor to have Rabbi Feldstein come to introduce the
speech. Not a rabbi.
Michael.
I haven't gotten my paper yet. Good evening and thank you all for coming. My name is Michael Feldstein and I'll be chairing tonight's program, which is sponsored by End the Madness. We're very fortunate to have two superb speakers address the various halachic, medical, and ethical issues surrounding genetic screening. Rabbi Moshe Tendler, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, will speak about behavioral genetics, a Torah perspective. Rabbi Kenneth Brander, the Dean of the Center for the Jewish Future, will speak about the ethics of genetic screening. After the program, both speakers will take some questions from the audience on this very difficult but important topic. First, I'd like to thank Rabbi Walensky and the kind folks at Ohev Tzedek for graciously offering to host tonight's program. I'd also like to thank Hanani Weissman, the founder of End the Madness, and Daniel Cronengold for their assistance in promoting the program tonight. Finally, is Rabbi Eckstein here? I'd like to acknowledge Rabbi Eckstein, the founder and the executive director of Dor Yesharim, who's here tonight. Rabbi Eckstein has brought along some literature about Dor Yesharim, which you're welcome to take if you'd like more information about this organization. And if you have some specific questions about how the organization works, Rabbi Eckstein is available to speak to people after the program concludes. In terms of End the Madness, our basic goal is to alleviate the needless stresses and hardships of dating in the observant Jewish community. We aim to accomplish this by expanding the range of available dating options for observant Jewish singles and to give people the confidence to explore the options that are most amenable to them on an individual level. There are some copies of some flyers announcing two future End the Madness events which are outside on the table. We're sponsoring a Tuba of Game Night at Congregation Gilad Jezrin in Manhattan on Wednesday, August 9th, for those under 30 years old, with pizza being served. Also on Sunday, August 27th, on Jewish Heritage Day, we'll be gathering at Chase Stadium before the Mets-Phillies game for the third annual World's Largest Kosher Tailgate Party. And if you haven't been to our two previous tailgate parties, they're terrific, terrific events, lots of fun for everybody of all ages. See the flyer for details about these fine programs, none of which will feel like a typical singles event, we promise. Before I introduce our speakers, I'd like to remind everybody to turn off their cell phones. Rabbi Moshe Tendler is the Rabbi Isaac and Bella Tendler Professor of Jewish Medical Ethics and is a professor of biology as well as being a Rosh Yeshiva at the Yeshiva Rav Yitzchak Elchanan at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Tendler is the leading expert on medical ethics as it pertains to Jewish law. He is the author of Practical Medical Halacha, a textbook of Jewish response to medical issues, and Pardes Rimonim, a book about the halachot of Taharat HaMishpacha. Rabbi Tendler is currently the rabbi of the Community Synagogue of Muncie, New York, and is the chairman of the Bioethical Commission, the RCA, and the Medical Ethics Task Force of the UJA Federation of Greater New York. It's my great honor and privilege to introduce Rabbi Moshe Tendler.
Pleasure having Mr. Feldstein as my host in Stamford not so long ago. Wonderful evening in Zionodo, which the whole community participated. A rare occurrence when Zionodo is usually reserved for the Chevra Kadisha. It showed an entire community expressing its appreciation. The topic I chose to discuss is one that is now developing. A lot of technology preceded the development of the PET machine, which enables an observer to see your thinking has been very, very instructive in trying to determine motivation of people. Basically, it's still the old battle of nature versus nurture. Namely, to what extent is our behavior predetermined by our genetic makeup? Everybody knows that it is. You heard someone loses his temper in shul, and the other one will comment, "You think he has a bad temper? You should have heard his father." Assumption being, if the father had a bad temper, that's why he has a bad temper. That's a genetic statement. Indeed, learned not so long ago in Pipiovos, Arba Midos, four types of people, some are Noach Lichos, they get angry quickly, and Noach Litzos, they forgive easily, and some are Noach Litzos, Noach Lichos, and Kosher, Lirtos, they get angry easily and keep their anger for long periods of time. Is that a genetic statement? Neurophysiology is presenting a kind of Calvinist view of predestination. Some people have a genetic makeup that predestines them to behave in a certain way. I will specify in a minute. When that certain way is criminal, when that certain way involves sins, then we have neurophysiology and Bechira Chofshis and free will, a foundation of our faith. Or the entire Western legal system is now under attack. For in our Western legal system, we also differentiate between coerced activity and voluntary activity. And if indeed you are predetermined by your genes to behave in a certain way, then how can you be held responsible for it? And of course, how can we believe that we have free will, the feel of hopes, when we have been imbued with genes which leads us to sin, to criminality? Let me give you a little bit of the background. It really began Of course, you don't have a screen PowerPoint, which is the way we use it. I mean, we have a PowerPoint for the AGS. Yeah. Shabbos Nachamu at the Granite Hotel, what we speak called Granite Hotel. The AGS is having its convention, and I'll be speaking there. In 1848, Phineas P. Gage really set in motion neurophysiology, or more importantly, neuroethics. He was a worker on the railroad, and they were blowing down the side of the mountain in the old-fashioned way, drill a hole, load it up with nitroglycerin, put on wads of cloth, tamped it down so that the explosion goes the way you want. As he was doing so, I don't know if you can, anyone can see this, the crowbar went through his eye, through his head. Believe it or not, he walked to the hospital where they cut up the crowbar, did nothing much for him, he recovered, but with a changed personality, where before he was a gentle, considered individual, became aggressive, tendency to criminality, and they began to speak about the moral center of the brain. Of course, in terms of cells, biology, not will, free will, moral decision. Idea that violence is determined by a center in the brain, or the absence of that center is what allows for violence to develop, really launched this whole notion, and it did nothing until the 1960s or so, and then it exploded in a number of ways. Some of you remember the tumult of the bell curve, in which genetic basis of intelligence was proposed to the detriment of certain groups of society, and the nature-nurture issue makes it regular. I think only a few months ago there was a beautiful article in the New York Times, not a beautiful paper, but a beautiful article in the New York Times that spelled it out very nicely. We have some solid evidence for an aggression gene. Solid evidence, unquestionable, that anyone who has this gene has a tendency for aggression. HMAO, as it's called, and there are families in the mountain with the Ozarks that carry this gene, and they're all really not nice people to meet. Everyone has spent time in jail for rape, murder, etc., etc. Right now, we avoid certain research programs. Thirty % of the black community between the ages of 20 and 40 are in jail today. Is there a black gene for criminality? People are afraid to touch the program. There's a major grant that's waiting to be started, and political pressure doesn't allow it to be started because we don't want to do that. We don't want to say there is a genetic basis for criminality and thus discriminate against a subset of society. But the papers keep on pushing certain behavior patterns and claim it to be genetic. The issue was raised a few years ago. A good friend of mine, one of the finest medical ethicists in the world today, Ron Steinberg, who just got into trouble with that multiple organ donation, organ transfer at Charité Hospital, which he approved. published Encyclopedia of Medical Ethics, most likely a work that rivals anything that's ever been written in the last 200-300 years for its massive mastery of a field in halacha and in medicine. He's a pediatric neurologist at Shari Tzedek and head of medical ethics at Hadassah there. And he published recently arguing that you should not abort a child who has the gene for the gay lifestyle. Obviously, he had been sold on this notion, which is an incorrect error that he made. There is no such gene for the gay lifestyle, even though they might march down Fifth Avenue in a parade. They don't have the gene. They only have the Yetzer Hara, but not the gene. The question was, should you abort the child that has the gay gene in him, if there is such a thing? That issue was discussed, as is done in an article, but nevertheless pushes that notion further. So right now, we have a genetic basis for behavior which we find to be unacceptable. The MAOA gene, that is solid. That's the only one that's been proven. It's a gene for violence, no doubt about it. There's a thyroid receptor B, beta receptor 3, which is a gene for hyperactivity. By the way, that same gene may be involved in risk-taking, that people who do crazy things like hang gliding and climbing the top of mountains they shouldn't be climbing seem to have a higher incidence of that gene than other people. As we know, there are psychiatric conditions that are genetically linked, such as paranoid schizophrenia. And then you have an issue that's, I'll describe a little bit more. Is there a gene for alcoholism and for drug abuse? The literature tries to present a gene for sexual orientation, and I've done that carefully. Several papers that have claimed that there's a gene, a genetic basis of sexual orientation, were all written by people of the gay community. No one from another community has ever been able to repeat that work. Is there an addiction gene? There seems to be some evidence that there is. In August 03, a fairly impressive article appeared in Science, one of the, I believe in my opinion, one of the two most reputable scientific journals that we have, Science and Nature, genes behind campus drinking. And they showed that indeed there's a higher incidence of a specific gene, short form as they call it, among the people who drink heavily on the campus. And thus they came up with a notion that addiction is a brain ailment, not a moral lapse. But somehow it's a gene that most likely is acquired not from parents, but from admission to certain colleges. That seems to go with it, a kind of a gene transfer that goes from the admission office to the student. We are part of a not me generation. We are looking for an excuse, not me. Or as some refer to it, as the geneing of America. It's all in the genes. A way to deny personal obligation. There is no moral basis for such a conclusion. some of the most sensitive studies that I've read concern the interaction of a genetic makeup with a social condition. Beautiful paper on the high incidence of violence among children that have been mistreated. And all of them have that monoamine oxidase gene that I mentioned that leads to be a violence gene. Further confirmatory evidence. But when they study, you realize strange things. You study for that gene exists in other children who are perfectly healthy, normal, gentle, etc. And you need the gene plus exposure to social violence. You need the gene plus his rejection by a mother, the gene plus his cruelty in the family. Together seems to develop a violent personality. But neither one alone does. Neither the social scene nor the genetic makeup. It is the combination of the two, interaction of nature with nurture, that determines an individual's personality. We'll soon show you how the halacha was sensitive to that. Came across only this month in Science, June 2nd, 2006, a gender difference that speaks to this topic, namely the moral significance of a genetic makeup. Where they don't speak of a specific genetic makeup, they speak of maleness versus the female condition. They show an interesting thing, that males and females who take the same drug, addiction rate among males is double that among females. In other words, maleness seems to predispose to addiction. Not the initial taking the drug, that you shouldn't be doing whether you're male or female. But those who are taking the drug, the addiction rate, inability to stop, is far greater among males. The second article, both in the same journal, the June 2nd journal, those who like to follow it, show also a difference in how, in response to a specific chemical, which is supposed to interfere with the arginine vasopressin chemical, it's supposed to interfere with a person's ability to remain gentle, calm, show a great difference between men and women, whereas men under the experimental conditions will view a neutral person as a foe. A female under the same conditions, with the same injection of the drug, will relate to the neutral person as a friend. Really, very significant difference in social interaction. The scientific community, maybe pushed by Wilson's sociobiology, is ready to accept a strong genetic basis to a point where you have articles appearing, the evolution of morality, that we are but the end of an evolutionary process, or the middle of an evolutionary process, in which we behave in a certain way because of our genetic makeup, including altruism being genetically determined. What does the halacha say? In the halacha we find some disturbing information as well. Gemara and Shabbos, and I've cooked and involved, and I scribble down the Mara Makomo, the source, in case someone wants to follow it up, I'll leave it with Rabbi Hananya, if someone wants to follow it too. We give a whole bunch of birthdays that are not exactly propitious. Haiman de Betrebe Shabbat, someone born on a Monday, will be a Ragzon, have a bad temper, right? Others will be a philanderer, etc., etc., etc. Amalu Rav Hanina, Hina denied. Lo mazal yom gorem, the mazal shor gorem. Depends on the time of the day, not the day. Amar Rav Yochanan, skipping down, ein mazal Yisrael. That's where they got that expression. It doesn't mean the Jews are shlamazals. Ein mazal Yisrael means we are not determined by the stars. We have a special personal relationship with the Bona Shel Olam that determines who we are, what we are. Go to the beginning of Bereshis. Vayomer Hashem Elokim hein odem hoya kacha mimeno das tov v'ra. So the Targum Onkelos says, Yichidi ba'omer lemeida tavu bish kegan, therefore I'm afraid. Man knows what's right and what's wrong. I didn't determine him to be bad or good. The Torah says I made him to be able to know what's good and bad. And therefore he can decide to be bad. Decide to be bad, he'll do even worse. He'll eat from the tree of everlasting life, and eat a chayim and he'll live forever. The Rambam and Hilchos Tshuva puts it as a foundation of our faith. Taking that pasuk, Hein odem hoya kacha mimeno da tovara. Kol ma shu chofet beini shiyakim b'yodo milasos tovara. Whatever he wants, no one will interfere in his choice of good or bad. A denial of a genetic linkage that compels him to be one way or another. Yet the Talmud was fully aware of the claim. And I think, as I said before, we began, someone has a bad temper and grew up in a family with people with bad tempers. We have to excuse him, it's not his fault. This is, read properly, this is a argument that the Gemara of Abasa associates with the book of Job, the book of Eve. And if you want to see something beautiful, if you haven't had a chance, look at the Hagdomah of the Malbim, the Sefer Eiv. The Malbim's introduction to the Sefer Eiv. So all of Sefer Eiv is really an answer to the question, is it nature or is it nurture that determines your moral composition, your moral personality? And according to our tradition, these most accepted one, the book of Eiv, book of Job, was written by Moshe Rabbeinu. Eiv lohoye or nivra, there never was an Eiv. This was a book to answer the big question. Tzadik v'ralo, Roshe v'toblo, how did he become a tzadik, how did he become a Roshe? And there, Job's question is posed in the Talmud beautifully. The Bona Shel Olam, the Rosso Shor Pasosa Stukos, you created an ox with split hoofs. Chamo, a donkey, pasosos klutos. Why did you create one kosher, one not kosher? You felt like doing it. God, you decided to do that. That the split hoof is kosher, not the hoof is trait, right? Barosa ganeidim, barosa gehenim. Barosa tzadikim, barosa rishoim. Mi ma'ake vayotcha. You made tzadikim, you made rishoim. A Calvinist doctrine. God puts in the world Rishon Tzadikim, and if you're a Rosha, you go to Gehenna, if you're a Tzadik, you go to Gan Eden. No matter what you do on earth, it makes no difference. It's all been predestined, which was the Calvinist doctrine. This was a question that the Gemara puts into the mouth of Eiv. And God answers, Elihu, the youngest of his friends, answered properly, not so. Man determines his own fate. God does not determine whether man is a tzaddik or a rosha, not genetically, nor by decree. Rabbeinu Yonah, in the Shari Tshuva, says something that should have been taught to me as well as to you in early years, took many years later to find, who says as follows, you should know, there's a mitzvah asay, ubacharta b'chayim, rei, a pasuk in Nitzavim, in Parshas in Sefer Devarim. Rei, nesati b'necha yom es ha-chayim, es ha-tehu, es ha-movet, es ha-ro, good and bad, death and life. Ha-dosi b'chem, es ha-shemayim, es ha-oretz, I swear by heaven and earth, ha-chayim, ha-movet, nesati b'ponecha, I gave it to you. U-bachato b'chayim, l'mantichi ha-tehu, es ha-recha. I command you to pick life, but if you don't want to listen to me, you pick whatever you want. It's a command no different than Shabbos, Kashrus, it's a command to pick life. It's a Rabbeinu Yonah that emphasizes the mitzvah livko b'chayim. It's the mitzvah of the Torah to choose the right way. But it's your right, your privilege, or your detriment to choose the wrong way. To choose the wrong way a number of ways. Rambam and Hilchos Deos point out they can choose the wrong way by choosing the wrong society, not the wrong parents. Wrong parents don't make you bad, but wrong friends can make you bad. There are B'riyoso Sha'olam and Peyek Shishi of Hilchos Deos, these Nimsho B'riyoso B'masav Achareo B'chaveiro. Therefore, if your friends are bad, change your friends. If your community is bad, he says, change your community. If your state is bad, if your country is bad, leave the country. But even if it means Yesei lema'olos or lechavochim or lemidboros, then I go up to a mountaintop and go out into the desert and live alone. Because the one thing you have to worry about is social, the sociology of ethics, or the sociological impact on individuals, that is the most dangerous. That's your will. That's your decision. You live where you want. The Torah gives us a special insight in the development of an ethical personality. And with it, teach you pshat and a pasuk that no one seems to understand. Yaakov has a dream in Parshas Vayetze. And in the dream, God promises him, Anochi eini imoch, I'll be with you. I'll take care of you. You don't have to worry about it. And Yaakov wakes up and wants to respond to Kadosh Baruch Hu with a great promise. What did he say? He takes a vow, Yidol Yaakov neder lemo. Im yia elokim imodi, God will indeed keep his promise, and give me lechem lecho or beged ulbosh, food to eat, clothes to wear, right? Then what? Chol asher titen li atzer asenu bo. Whatever he'll give me, I'll give him back 10%. I don't make that deal with anybody. Big deal. You give me 100%, I'll give you back 10%. Very nice. That's the best Yaakov could do in response to this fabulous promise of Kodesh Baruch Hu Anochi Yehi Imoch. What's the base of his neder, response of neder? People miss. Asa Senaloch asked them to teach the Jews you're supposed to give 20% of what God gives you to others less fortunate. Asa Senaloch, 2 times 10%. The promise of Yaakov was, Vohoya Hashem li l'elokim. Hashem is the personal God who gave us the Torah. Elokim is the God of nature, who gives us immutable laws of nature. And Hashem, I can refuse to listen to. Mosa ha'odom min ha'beim ha'oyin, we say, the difference between man and animal is oyin, that man can say oyin, man can say no. Animals are driven by instinct, they can't say yes or no. Boy Hashem, li l'elokim, from now on, whereas I know I can oppose God's orders, he's Hashem and he allows me free will. From now on, Hashem li will be elokim, will be like a law of nature in which I will not question anymore. And that's why when Yaakov met Laban, he told him, im Laban garti, and Rashi quotes the Medrash, v'tarayag mitzvah shomarti, and I observed all the mitzvahs, so Esau, don't start up with me. If you look in the Medrash Priyam, beautiful Medrash, adds a few words. Im Laban garti, v'tarayag mitzvah shomarti, u'pora aduma hikrafti, and I brought a pora aduma. What does that mean? Paraduma symbolizes the mitzvos that we don't understand. So Yaakov told Esau, don't argue logically with me, intellectually, emotionally with me. I brought a paraduma already. I've accepted God no matter what he says, whether I understand him or not. I've already changed from Hashem to Elohim. Boy Hashem li l'Elohim. Fundamental Jewish law and ethics denies the nature of genetic influence on man's moral conduct. Social influences are mentioned, yes, but not genetic. The time doesn't permit, the topic is a great and wondrous topic, really. In Yeshiva, we're learning the Sefer Kedushin. And we finished the fourth parak in my shiur. Rabbi Haupt sitting here, have the good fortune of having him in my shiur. At the end, in the Mishnayos, in the Teferes Yisrael, the commentary on Mishnayos, in order to defend a difficult phrase in the Gemara, that Tov shebarokim legehenim, that the best doctors will go to Gehenna. And the person was disturbed by that one. He tried to somehow get another understanding of it. So he tried to read into it that Tov Shebarokim means a doctor who is so egotistical, he considered himself to be the best and never asked advice of anybody else. It's a way out, reaching out to try to get some better understanding. I've heard other reasons, some of you know them, the Tevet Samsofa, Tov Shebarokim, Tov is 17, the Gematria. And the Shmona Esther is 18. One of them is Rafa'enu, a doctor who leaves out one of the 18. When it comes to Rafa'enu, he doesn't say, Rafa'enu, I can do that myself. He says, don't go to Gehenna. I heard recently a very sensitive explanation from a good doctor in Eretz Yisrael who said, Tov Shebarokim, the best doctor gets the worst cases. They send him terrible cases. He has a reputation to be the best doctor. He's a good doctor, he empathizes with his patients. So every evil of the world, every medical problem, every family horror is in the mind of this poor doctor. He lives a life of Gehenna as a Tov Shebarokim, for he empathizes with his patients over and over again. For some reason, he included there, at the very end of his commentary on the Mishnah, a story about Moshe Rabbeinu. I'll say it only quickly because time doesn't permit. Arab chef had heard about the great Moshe Rabbeinu, wanted to know what he looked like. So he sent his portrait artist out. And he drew a picture and came back. And in those days, now they do a little bit of the science of physiognomy, where you study a picture and you understand the personality of the individual. He showed it to his physiognomist. He said, that's the picture of an evil man. They cannot be. He heard about reputation Moshe Rabbeinu. So he says either the artist lied, didn't go out there, just drew a picture, or the physiognomists are idiots, all put both their heads. They each pleaded, Noah, we did an honest job, an honest day's work. Did an actual portrait of the, and the physiognomist said, no, it follows all the rules. Finally, the curiosity got the best of him, he saddled his camel, went out and met the Moshe Rabbeinu, and saw that the picture is accurate. He says, oh, the physiognomist must have lied. So he told Moshe the whole story, and Moshe says, no, it's true. I was born with all the bad tendencies. Only by willpower I overcame them. Now this little story exploded in the Talmud community. And one of my Talmidim this year, Seth Nadel, was kind enough to find in the library an article written by one of our professors, by Sid Lyman, on the origin of this story. Shows that the story was written hundreds of years before about Aristotle. It was written about Plato. It's a some of it from Christian literature. Somehow the Tzitzisar picked up the last version, which associated with Moshe Rabbeinu. Not that anyone believed the story was true, but the important message was true that the Tzitzisar was trying to get across. Namely, there's no such thing as a tosha b'rofim l'gehenim, that a man will go to gehenim. It depends on how he behaves. A doctor can be a great surgeon because of his innate tendencies. He could be, unfortunately, Jack the Ripper because of his innate tendency, ability to take a knife and cut a human being. Whether he applies the knife to heal or to hurt is determined by his moral nature, not by his genetic nature. And that is the basic message. But that's really what the Torah taught us a long time ago. Again, we have a big problem with elementary school education, that we don't teach Chumash. That's the problem. We teach something that's called Chumash, but don't teach Chumash. Chaim says to God, after he killed his brother Hevel, Hashom el ochi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? What kind of a chutzpah did Chaim have? Chaim knew he was talking to God. He's going to play games with God. Chaim, if he was a chatzuf, why did God order us to put in the Torah? God can left out that pasuk. But if a sofer will say, I'm not going to write that chutzpah in the Torah and leave that pasuk out, the sefer Torah is puzzled. You can't use that sefer Torah. You must put in there what Chaim said to God. Hashem Elochi Anochi. Let me tell you what Chaim said. Chaim said to God, Hashem Elochi Anochi, am I responsible? You are responsible. You gave me the genes to be a murderer. Had you not given me the genes to be a murderer, I couldn't have killed my brother. And God said to him, I told you a long time ago when you brought your sacrifice, which they didn't like, these rotten vegetables that you brought as a sacrifice. I told you, La Pesa Chatas Rovets, sin lies at the door. They let her to shuk or so, and you have a tendency to sin. I gave you that tendency. I gave everybody different tendencies. But Ba'ata Tim Shobo, I gave you the ability to conquer it. Sure, we have different tendencies. Maybe I have a bad temper because my father had a bad temper. Maybe indeed there are tendencies which come from a genetic makeup. But they do not determine a person's behavior. Behavior is not genetically determined. Tendencies are determined by genetics. And then comes the Torah and tells you how to overcome these tendencies. Hasefo v'asayot yodu kuchim in Hashemoyim. The Medrash says, the book, the Torah, and the sword came down from heaven intertwined like a DNA molecule. And Kodesh Baruch Hu said, sure, everything has a potential for the sword. Everything can turn to evil. But I gave you a Torah to sheathe the sword. If the Kaibu Mashakosa Vasefa, do what it says in the book, you have nothing to worry about the sword. Thank you.
Rabbi Kendler. Rabbi Kenneth Brander is the Dean for the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. After serving as the Senior Rabbi of the Boca Raton Synagogue, and the dean of the Boca Raton Community Kollel. Rabbi Brander was the first recipient of the Yeshiva University Wexner Rabbinic Leadership Award in 1999. Most recently, he was honored with the State of Israel Medal of Honor presented by the mayor of Gush Etzion for rabbinic leadership in supporting Gush Etzion. In 1999, he received an advanced level of ordination from Alfon Pua and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, acknowledging the rabbi's particular expertise in the area of Taharas HaMishpacha, infertility, gynecological procedures, and their interface with Halacha. Rabbi Brander will be speaking about the ethics of genetic screening. It's my honor and privilege to introduce Rabbi Kenneth Brander.
Thank you very much for the introduction. The Rav, the Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Tendler. It's a privilege to spend a few minutes with you to share with you a little bit about the issues of the ethics of genetic testing. I would like to really share with you two stories, one from the Gemara and one a personal story, and then share with you two tshuvot, and then really just sum up a few words afterwards. In fact, one of the tshuvot is from Rav Moshe Feinstein, and the tshuva was actually written to Rabbi Tendler. So let me begin with these two stories, again with a few words that are found within the tshuvot of the Achronim, some comments from Rishonim, and then to close my remarks. There's a very famous Gemara that discusses argument between the governor of Judea, Turnus Rufus, and Rabbi Akiva, where Turnus Rufus says to Rabbi Akiva, I want to tell you that the reason why you, the Jewish people, are condemned to Gehenna is because you helped the poor. And Turnus Rufus explains to Rabbi Akiva why the Jewish people who help the poor are condemned to Gehenna. He says the following. Suppose a king decided to incarcerate one of his subjects and said to all of those who live under his rule that no one is to give any food, no one is to give any drink to the subject that he, the king, has incarcerated. And someone, in a clandestine way, snuck food to this individual that the king had incarcerated. Would not the king be very angry at the individual who snuck food to the person that the king had incarcerated, to the person that the king had demanded that no one give him or her food? And you, the Jewish people, are considered the servants of God, and therefore you need to listen to God. If God decides that this person should be poor, you have no right to give this person any food to eat. The Rekiva responds with the following comment. Suppose the king would decide to incarcerate his son and told everybody that his son should not get any food to eat or anything to drink. And someone clandestinely snuck food to the king's son. Would not the king really be happy that someone had really brought food to his son? And we, the Jewish people, are not just called the servants of God, we're also called God's children. This argument, this statement, this story between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to explain this story with the following understanding, to create the following paradigm. That there is essentially a philosophical discussion going on here between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. Turnus Rufus says that, you know, Turnus Rufus is explaining to Rabbi Akiva that a person needs to look at the world through the glasses of God. If God decides that this person should have a certain ailment, if God decides that this person should be poor, you have no right to change the destiny of that person. And therefore, Turnus Rufus says to Rabbi Akiva, when a Jew helps a poor person, that Jew is condemned to Gehenna because they are changing the fate and the destiny of the world. They are interrupting the majesty and the direction of God. And Rabbi Akiva says to Tirtas Rufus the following. We human beings, we Jews, have no right to wear the glasses of God. We have a responsibility to imitate God. We have a responsibility to be partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but we dare not wear the glasses of God. And when we see challenges within this world, if we can help fix the world, and if we are blessed to do so, then we must celebrate that capacity. We must celebrate that gift. And we are the children of God. We are commanded, and it is a demand by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to taken olam b'malchut shakai, to finish in the completion of the world, to imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to be God's partner. Science has given us an unbelievable opportunity. As in all cases, when there are opportunities, there are often challenges that go with it. Rabbi Tendler is much more competent to discuss the challenges that often go with the gifts of science. But genetic testing should be viewed as a gift. When used properly, it empowers and allows us to obviate some of the challenges and some of the pain that often individuals have to go through. And we should recognize the greatness of this divine gift. And when used properly, with the appropriate parameters, with the appropriate sense of confidentiality, in the appropriate context, with the appropriate recognition of its roles and functions, we should recognize it as it is a gift. The second story is not one from the Gemara, it's the page of personal history. Approximately a little less than 13 years ago, my wife and I were blessed with our fourth child. She was born right after Tisha B'Av, around two B'Av time, and we named her. It was a joyful experience. I'll never forget, my children were still in day camp, so it was actually a time in which we actually had time to bond with our daughter in the first few days, few hours of her life. And then as I'm picking up my children from day camp, I get this phone call, this frantic phone call from my wife, telling me that I must rush back to the hospital, that my daughter, our daughter, was put into the NICU, which is a neonatal intensive care unit for babies, and that she is having trouble breathing. It went from bad to worse, and a few days later, our daughter passed away. During this whole trauma, the trauma was more complicated for a host of different reasons. One is we weren't living with family. Two is we had already, three children at home, and they were all young. Four was my wife was recovering from the birth, so the baby was actually flown to another hospital. And therefore, she was in one hospital, the baby was in another hospital, which goes through a whole bunch of stuff. Five, it's never a good time to go through a difficult experience, but it's harder when you're not with your spouse, especially when your spouse is recuperating. At the end of this ordeal, or during this ordeal, we found out that what the baby suffered from was a beta stress infection that she had received after my wife apparently had this group, it's called beta stress, groupie stress, and there are signs, the American College of Pediatrics actually at that time, 12 years ago already, listed the signs, which were pretty clear, whatever they are not important. My wife had all the signs, the early labor, fever during the labor, ruptured membranes, all the standard protocols. The American College of Obstetrics had not yet created protocols, but the bottom line is that if my wife would have been given two bags of penicillin, approximately $10 to $12 worth, we would not have just five children at home, we would have six children at home. and the $500,000 of insurance bills that went through the operations and everything that this baby had the first few days would not have been necessary if simply my wife would have gotten 2 bags of antibiotics before and during labor. After we dealt with the loss of a child, we went to the OBGYN, and we had one question for the OBGYN. The only question that we had was, the next time a young woman has these signs of beta stress, again, whatever they are, again, this is not the time to go through them, will you at least check her, do the check, which is simply no different than testing for strep virus in the throat. It's a similar type of procedure that's done in the vaginal area, and make sure that this that the mother gets the 2 bags of necessary penicillin. His response was, I went into obstetrics because I didn't want to have to deal with death. That's why I went into obstetrics, and I have no intention of testing for the future. We didn't have to do anything. People heard this response because he shared it with another doctor or so, and he never practiced again in South Florida. Simply, the doctors literally protested against him. I don't even know if he practices anymore. I was personally devastated by this. My wife decided that she would not allow the situation to end like this. She went to Tallahassee. She met our local state senator. His name is Robert Wexler. He interacted with our local state senator at that time, Robert Wexler, explained to him our loss, and asked there to be a state mandate that all OBGYNs should have to have practice parameters in order to be able to deal with the issue of croupy stress. Robert Wexler was taken with my wife's presentation, a little hard not to be, and they created practice parameters for the state of Florida. Robert Wexler actually became Shomer Shabbos through this interaction. We kashered his house. He's now a member of the United States Congress. We've become very close. But the bottom line is, the state of Florida created practice parameters. Eventually, the CDC created a branch or a department within the CDC that created protocols for dealing with groupie stress, and eventually these practice parameters were adopted throughout the country. Not anymore, but over the past 10 years or so, there's at least once or twice a month that we get a phone call from somebody who heard that we helped establish these practice parameters and thanks us because their child, that they had groupie stress, and because of the practice parameters, which again are quite simple, their child was saved from any challenges. My point of sharing with you this story is not for you to feel any, it's not for you to feel pity. Baruch Hashem, we have 5 beautiful children at home. We never take one moment of their life for granted. They're all special in their own right, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been very good to us. But the reason why I share this with you is because it would seem to me quite obvious, after losing a child, for no reason other than the fact that there weren't appropriate practice protocols put into place, that if we could create a situation that would obviate a couple from having the challenges of having a Tay-Sachs baby, if we could create a way in which we could obviate certain other genetic challenges, it would seem to be a no-brainer that we shouldn't try to do that. Yes, again, it needs to be done in an appropriate fashion, but it seems to me that why should any person, and with us it wasn't an issue of a genetic issue, but if those practice parameters were put into place, we would have been able to obviate these challenges. It seems to me that if there's appropriate ways of genetic testing, why not use them in order to obviate some of the challenges that we may have? This idea of genetic screening is something that is also discussed in many different locations. I'll just mention 2 or 3 of them. The Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, Chelek Gimel, Perek Mem Tet, discusses it and perhaps suggests that many of the prohibitions, the sexual norms and mores regarding who one can marry might be predicated on the issue of appropriate genetics. There's actually a volume, NOAM, which is an interesting magazine, the 12th volume actually takes that idea and develops it in greater, amplifies it in a great, from a greater perspective. The Ibn Ezra quotes in Perek Bet, Pasuk Aleph, highlights this idea when it discusses the story of Yocheved re-engaging in her marriage to re-engaging in her marriage, and it speaks about how it speaks about a Bas Levi, and Ibn Ezra says some people say that she took that she was related to her husband. Velo davar nechona. This is not accurate, because we know that the best way for a crop, in this case, for it means child, to be able to seed properly is when one seeds not within their own field, not within their own family, but when one seeds in a different field, in a different family. The recognition of sometimes genetic challenges if one marries too close within one's family. And this is a... It's always uncomfortable to speak about anything from Rabbi Tendler, let alone the notion of Kavah Chomer, speak about a tshuva that was written to Rabbi Tendler from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. But assuming this tshuva is accurate, in Ibn Ezer, Chayot Dalet Siman Yud, there's a question that Rabbi Tendler asked to his father-in-law, one of the Posek Hador, and that is regarding Pesach before marriage, if one should test. And while Rav Moshe has some appropriate ideas regarding issues of confidentiality, he does seem to indicate the responsibility or the opportunity to test, and the testing should be done in a way in which you can achieve that there are not two carriers that get married one to another. It would seem to me that, you know, based on the gift of science, as we find in this argument between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, where we're reminded that the ills of society the ills within the world can often be fixed by the greatness of society and the human endeavor. It would seem to me that based on certain statements that are highlighted within Rishonim, whether it's the Rambam, whether it's the commentary that I mentioned of the Ibn Ezra and Shemot, and most importantly, the statement by Rav Moshe Feinstein, it would seem to me that when it comes to significant challenges like issues of Pesach and others, that there should be no reason why we should not encourage some form of genetic testing. Now, I can understand there is different approaches to genetic testing. There are those that suggest that one should follow the Dor Yesharim approach. And that is that individuals get tested, and basically what happens is you don't know if you're a carrier or not. You call up, again, the person who runs through your Sharm is here, so it's a little hard again for me to explain it in great depth, but essentially you get tested, the person you're dating perhaps was tested or gets tested, and you check whether both of you are carriers, and then you're warned about concretizing the relationship. But if not, you're not informed at all. There are those that feel that that's a very good approach. Most recently at Yeshiva University, there were actually 50 students that were involved in Dor Yesharim testing. There are those who suggest that one should be tested and be informed whether they're carriers or not. That I'll leave up to everybody's own individual feelings and perhaps everyone's individual rabbinic halachic advisor. But clearly, the opportunity and the ability to be tested in ways that are confidential, in ways that allow us to deal with these issues, is something that is possible. And I think that it would be wrong for us to be in a situation in which we would not go through some basic opportunities to test and chas v'shalom create challenges for a couple, for the Jewish community, and not to repair some of the challenges that may come up within society. But that does not mean to suggest that somebody who is carrying a child that has challenges, that there's some permission to abort. That does not suggest that if somebody is carrying a child that may have certain challenges in life, that one has the right to decide the future of that child once the child is already in utero, once the child is a fetus. That, I don't think, is halakhically permitted. Perhaps a Tay-Sachs child, according to one or two poskim, may be permitted, but clearly, other than something as significant as that, I'm not aware of any poskim that would permit an abortion. But we're not talking about here situations of abortion. We're talking about simply, in a proactive way, trying to obviate some of the challenges that may happen, and in this case I'm referring to, in particular, Tay-Sachs. There is, I think one of the issues that sometimes also comes up is that once a couple feels that they are carriers, they may use alternative ways of having children, and that is using IVF, in vitro fertilization, and then PGD afterwards. I'm not convinced that I'm not convinced that's how PGD should be used. If individuals know that they have challenges before they get married, I think they have to reevaluate whether they want to concretize the relationship or not. But clearly, after marriage, if a couple knows that they're having certain genetic challenges, and through an IVF procedure coupled with the use of PGD, a pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, that one can obviate certain genetic challenges also, that would seem to be another way of dealing with certain genetic challenges. But I think the goal and the purpose of my few minutes of sharing my feelings is that minimally, when couples are dating, or when the man and a woman are thinking about getting married, even before they start dating, when they're thinking about getting married, there's nothing wrong with going through genetic screening in order to ensure that the challenges that they may have are obviated, and that's the gift of science, and I think that we should use it to be involved in partnering with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in helping to make sure that we remove some of the challenges that often may come in this world. Thank you very much.
We're going to take some questions from the audience now. This is an important part of tonight's program, and in order to make sure that the question and answer session is most productive, we do ask that you keep your comments focused on a particular issue that one of the speakers discussed, and that you ask a specific question rather than ramble on endlessly. Are there any questions?
Yeah, can you take this off?
Yes.
How effective is genetic screening?
Or either one?
Done properly, it's 100% effective. And how effective is it when it's done? I don't know whether it's proper or not. I have now a case of the cystic fibrosis in which they went to the pre-implantation diagnosis and ensured that the fetus did not carry the gene. Unfortunately, the fetus did carry the gene. There's a human error that comes in, steals the organ, the cells are came. Meaning the human errors come in, but by and large, the newest method is done properly. The triple DNA screen should be close to 100% effective, barring lab error.
Any other questions? Rabbi Epstein, do you want to make any comments?
I have an observation. The Moshe Nachmanides said that the Dover Z shows the cost of Kedush. I have in the classes of my over 20 years that we work in genetics to encourage the community to be tested and prevent this terrible disease. And then the pastor faced objections that, well, Mr. Hussein, I'm going to say, don't get involved in. So I say, seems to me that the Gemara has such an arisa, every word in the Gemara means something. So I said, I think that when somebody is starting to make prima maestra, and that don't do testing because you don't get involved in sort of world business, this seems that this is a child of question of prosperity. This doesn't belong to a real LFSD. Because until you ask the child, the person can die, you don't give it to eat. In order to child to do it, first you have to give it to eat, you have to prevent it, you have to make sure that the children are not born. I'm just trying to mention two more places where you want to mention the importance of being tested, which is also mentioned in Ebenezer, and later on in the South Mr. Matarone. And then is an interesting Gemara in Bechoret, which says Gemara lo yisa Gemara and nanas lo yisa nanas. It means a very high person corporate couldn't take the same, because they may be very, very too tall. So what it means is that there are two categories here. One is mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, and one is not mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch. So the question is, why is one Gemara mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch from this Pirkei Mutarot and one is not mentioned? So I think I can't demonstrate that, but I think that's the difference. Nisman and the Quran is probably a very higher list. Seems to be a kind of dominant trait, which is by statistics is 50%. So it's a lot more dangerous. Whereas wiser daughters are rather more the type of the sensitive type that you need two carriers to produce the same trait. So, but there's no question in the Gemara that if you can do something to prevent and avoid tragedy, you shouldn't mess around and don't play games with that and not stomach the child that you may do abortion or not. You have to be protected before you go in serious commitment. Thank you for listening.
So you said in the modern Orthodox school, did you suggest on date number one that you put out the information, or at what point for the information actually
received?
It's one thing if it's a shit-out situation in the black and white world, but I think it's the modern Orthodox school.
You know, when during this year we made a decision to offer in an accepting at Yeshiva University, and Dr. Gross from Einstein, we met with her, and there was a whole discussion about what opportunities we should offer. And some were advocating that we should use Dorie Sharon, and some were advocating we should just do genetic testing and let people know straight away. I personally feel that both opportunities should be offered to the community, and that each individual should make their own decision. I see strengths and weaknesses in both. I see strengths in Dorie Sharon as you won't feel a certain pressure. The anonymity, yet being protected, allows you the opportunity not to feel that when you're dating somebody, you're a carrier yourself. That if you don't communicate it, you have violated something. You're not communicating to the person you're trying to develop a relationship with. And at the same time, the benefit of Dorie Sharon is that it's at a certain point we get serious. And those who have tested to Dorie Sharon have the wherewithal to find out if the genetic challenges are limited simply by placing a phone call. On the other hand, I'm always an advocate that a person having all the knowledge about themselves is a good thing. And the question then really has to be that maybe in this case it's a good thing, or maybe in this case it's better to do it in the way that Dorothy Sharp has organized it, where the individual really doesn't have to make a decision when he has or she has to tell the person that he or she is dating about if they know the carrier, at what stage in the relationship or anything else about the nature, to simply have a way of doing sharp. So I personally think the modern Orthodox community, or even the social world that I have difficulty with, for the strong community that resonates in our orbit, that I think that both opportunities should be available, and I think each individual should decide what he or she is comfortable with. There are some that will be comfortable with, I want to know exactly, I'll keep the information, and I'll make a decision when I want to share it. And there's some that say, listen, I want to achieve the effectiveness of being protected, not to create additional challenges within the world, but I don't think I need to know all the details of the information, so I'll go for the reassurance. I think the opportunity to have both, I think the ability to have both opportunities available really allows each person their own freedom of making decisions. But I think engaging the ability to do it anyway, I think can lead to devastating outcomes, and I think that's the best strategy.
Yes.
We have two questions about what both of these questions were for the 20 years of experience. In all the time of all the testing done with some communities, has the incidence of these diseases, not just by the time that the world or the team much more diseases, has it significantly decreased, statistically significantly decreased in all the time, or is it still out there and it's just as often? The second question I have is also statistically. The testing is such a case that of these carriers, you find that thousands of people who have been tested have numbers that are weaker. The detailed patients of 114 case that is available, but that incident is what you're saying in the community.
The first question that is not statistically can be fact. There was a disease in the world, the department which had basically chosen to go into the Jewish Medical Center, which was always full with the waiting list. Unfortunately, waiting that the children, the child could die, that they should have a place for another one. So, if you would like to see a star, go around and see how many patients are there. I think at this point, maybe one. Somebody who didn't accept this test. Number two, statistics are pretty accurate. In the statistics, there are different versions. Those who say 1 in 30, those who say 1 in 25. You find 1 in 24, 1 in 23, because we are now the larger families, maybe, or there may be some other reasons, but the statistics are unfortunately true. And I would like to take one opportunity to explain a little more in detail about the issue, which is very important that the human beings must understand if they choose to do the issue. The issue does not have cost, not even they are not engaged, not married. We are only testing individuals. The individuals who are deciding to meet, they can call. There's no limit how many calls they do. The most preferred time to do the call is before any legal serious attachment is there. Why should we get a call after a couple is ready to go? No, don't go. That's not terrible. That's not what we are looking to do. Especially in in the community where you're ready to go out and when you make the decision, it's almost like that. So why do we wait so long for good as individuals? And before any serious commitment is there, we can call and there's no limit for the call.
Yes, Rabbi Chairman.
I'd like to ask another 18 that Brenda mentioned, one that I find it difficult to accept. I'd like to share my ideas in Yeshiva. I like to boast that I'm a real Yankee, I'm an American. I have Baruch Hashem great grandchildren who are six generations American. And America has a concept, the right to know. What is the rationale if a couple falls in and you tell them that it's incompatible? Why should you not tell them why it's incompatible? Now, Brenda mentioned not to tell a person in advance who wants to be checked that he has a genetic flaw, that he carries a recessive gene. He doesn't want to do with that information. But once you tell him that he can't marry this girl, he knows he has a recessive gene. He knows she has a recessive gene. That information is there. Which gene he doesn't know, but he knows he has a recessive gene. This is a question of integrity between a young man and a young lady. And in view, they have to tell her the truth. They have to tell her that I have a recessive gene, I don't know which one. But why can't they pick up the phone or send them a registered letter, a confidential, to tell you, to say that those are incompatible, and this is the gene. That makes a big difference in the later plans for a pre-implantation diagnosis. There are laboratories that specialize. Errors of cystic fibrosis occur regularly because the lab does it too infrequently. And I have a couple that we sent off to the Chicago lab there because they are better for this thing. I don't think that information should not be made available to the people. It goes against a fundamental ethical concept in America of a right of patients to know. I see no downside. I see no advantage to keep that secret.
I have to look for it. Well, we do give it information. We don't give information that somebody is compatible. We are not telling that, yes, the guy is a case of a sex, the girl is a case of a fear. No, that we don't say. But in the case when a couple is incompatible, I can respect the couple is incompatible, that may solve it. But nevertheless, when it comes to the
double with G,
not only that, there are sometimes CF different genes which are more severe or more mild. There are some genes in CF which only cause infertility and doesn't cause disease. So called, I can guarantee that, but that's what the literature says. I did see on those mutations problems, but that's what the literature claims. We do tell them. Here you have a milder case, here you have a more severe case. Then it's incompatible. And that is exactly what we are doing. And there is why I came here, because I thought that there is, how can I call it, governance, it's missing information. In the modern community, the program board, they can use it for their benefit. Basically, Doris Jordan did not make any medical invention except familiar with the phenomena. He said that we were involved in finding the gene. That's practical. But generally, we took the medical information and we adapted it to the community. So, naturally, the modern community needs a little, and they shape it up a little more to this belief, but the mind, even in our community, when it's not compatible, the people get it. Because they have to make their decision. They are not forcing
decision on anybody what to do. We give them the information, we give them the list, and then they have to be smart themselves, how to do.
We'll take one more question and then we'll break. What diseases are tested when you take the genetic screen?
Okay, I can comment for other hospitals, but there is a panel which is called the Ashkenazi Jewish panel, which consists from 9 to 12 different diseases. That is what different hospitals are doing themselves. We are doing 9 to 10. Gaucher, there is another ethical question, which is a mild disease, and we don't believe that when a couple has the Gaucher being a mild one, they shouldn't get married. Again, that's their decision. I say we are doing 10 diseases, but one of them is Gaucher, which you have to order specifically, because we don't believe that we need to enforce such a testing for people who don't know exactly the practicalities and the limitations. And we find that when you are close to get engaged, the motions are too high on the test. In the school, in the yeshiva, where we go for screening, we are charging 150. With vice, we can talk from 900 and up.
You should know that at Mount Sinai, the panel of 9 costs $2,900.
And I can tell you, we saw this here, a black hair guy. We do accept what we tell the person. Every batch has 7 to 10%. Previously known samples. That means that we know the results just to make sure that there is no mistake. And this increases the reliability. Somebody asked how reliable it is. Nothing that a human person does, like Alexander mentioned, can tell, somebody can say 100%. But it's almost 100% when you do it before. PGD is a more sensitive, more delicate test. So, as I unfortunately know from other states, to familiar with autonomia. But if you do it before you get engaged, before you get committed, the liability is almost 100%.
Thank you. Refreshments will be served downstairs. There will be a memorial service here after the program. You're welcome to speak to any of the panelists or Rabbi Epstein if you have specific questions. Thank you very much, Carmen. Thank you to our panelists. Good night.
Good evening.